This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is a bit of a hurricane hunter, but his chases don't involve high-tech airplanes or NASA satellites. No, a jury-rigged raft or simple hip waders are more likely MO. That's because the storms he's looking for happened decades, centuries, even millennia ago. Dr. Jeff Donnelly is associate scientist with tenure in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and he's the lead author on a new study showing that over the past 2,000 years, Cape Cod has, at times, been battered with storms of unprecedented frequency and intensity, with greenhouse gases driving ocean temperatures higher and higher, and sea level rising as well. Understanding that distant past could provide important clues to our future. Jeff Donnelly, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We invite you to join our conversation as well. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Jeff, we will get into the scientific value of studying past storm activity in a little while. But on a personal level, why do you study past storms?
I think I was interested in meteorology since I was a little kid. I think other kids wanted to be firemen, and I think I wanted to be with a weatherman on TV. So it's really just an extension of my 7 or 8 year old self.
But you didn't go the hurricane hunter route, the NASA meteorology route.
I was also very interested in the sandbox, I guess, and always fascinated with how the Earth works. And those sort of interests sort of came together and coalesced into trying to understand how climate has changed over long timescales.
So how do you track storms that happened centuries ago? What kind of evidence? I mean, it's not like they leave a fossil, right, in the rocks.
Right.
So what do you actually find left from storms that happened centuries ago?
In this case, we've been focusing on overwash deposits. And so typically the places like back barrier marshes and coastal ponds are very quiet, quiescent. There's not a lot of wave activity, that sort of thing. And so the sediment that's deposited there is usually very fine-grained, muddy, mucky sediment. What happens during a hurricane is that storm surge and waves overtop barrier beaches and effectively turn these environments into the open ocean, with very large waves crashing. And so then you're mobilizing the sand and gravel from the beach and the nearshore environment and depositing in these environments that don't usually see that sort of sediment. And so when we're taking these sediment cores in these environments, what we'll find is this alternation between this fine-grained organic mud that's being deposited day in and day out, and then this occasional event bed that's deposited during a hurricane.
So explain how you actually go out and take a sediment core. I mean, this is basically just a big, long tube of mud that you pull up out of the ground, right?
Right. So we have to set up some sort of raft or platform from which to take the core. And usually that's cobbled together with a couple of canoes or kayaks or something like that, depending on how deep the site is and how long the core we hope to take is. The core is usually just a 3-inch diameter aluminum pipe. It's like a really long straw. And just like you'd put a straw into a milkshake and put your finger over the top and extract a tube full of milkshake, we're extracting a tube full of mud. So in this case, we're driving this 3-inch aluminum tube, sometimes they're as much as 30 or 40 feet long, into the sediment, sometimes with the help of a vibracore. It's a vibrating motor that essentially liquefies the sediment and allows it to penetrate deeper. And then we extract it with a winch.
So then you take that back to the lab and you're just literally looking through it for layers of sand mixed in with the normal mud?
That's right, right. And oftentimes it's not as simple as just opening the core and looking. It's sometimes you can visually see these layers. Other times you actually have to go and analyze them centimeter by centimeter and try to actually count the grains that are there, the coarse grains versus the grains that are not, you know, that are there in the other intervals. So it ends up being years of lab effort, unfortunately, to get from the core to an actual result.
Can you tell when you're looking at a storm like that, whether you're looking at a hurricane or a nor'easter? I mean, different kinds of storms,
right?
Do they leave a different signature?
Right. Typically, in these kinds of environments, the there's a threshold where you need a storm of a certain intensity to get a deposit. And in that case, the nor'easters don't have the surge that's required in a lot of cases to get over these barriers. I mean, nor'easters have a lot of power and they last longer than hurricanes typically around here. They can last for 2 or 3 days over multiple tidal cycles, and they can certainly move a lot of sediment in the coastal zone. But given the places that we're targeting, those don't tend to be recorded. because the surge is required to get up over the barriers and transport this sediment, sometimes hundreds and hundreds of feet to where this depot center is, where the mud is collecting. The nor'easters aren't able to do that. So we've sort of targeted sites on the south-facing coast of New England that are much more vulnerable to hurricanes rather than nor'easters. If we wanted to look for nor'easters, we would probably look on a north or east-facing coast where you're actually getting that onshore strong wind from nor'easters.
We have records going back through ice or sediment records of temperature, of what atmospheric carbon dioxide levels were, right, of a lot of different climate indicators that can go back thousands, tens of thousands, even millions of years.
Right.
What kinds of records do we have of storm activity? Do we have those long records?
One of the motivations for doing this work is that we just have a very short record of storminess, in the sense that for hurricanes in the Atlantic, for example, the NOAA record only goes back about 160 years. And that's not a lot of time when you're dealing with these relatively rare events. So that's what sort of motivated us to try to develop these longer proxy records that might go back, you know, centuries or even millennia. At the moment, the longest record we have goes back about 7,000 years, and it's from some offshore sediments in the Bahamas. Most of the records we have only go back 1,000 or 2,000 years, and the reason for that is that sea level's been rising, and so these coastal landforms aren't stationary. They're actually migrating landward through time, gradually as sea level rises. And so, a site that might be recording a hurricane 5,000 years ago is probably offshore in Vineyard Sound right now. So I'd have to go out there and try to find it in order to try to reconstruct the record further back in time.
And then you'd also have to somehow reconstruct what the land looked like to know what used to be a coastal pond.
I mean,
is it possible to do that even?
It is. It's difficult. We have various geophysical tools where we can image the subsurface and try to reconstruct what the environment was and actually find these holes that might still be preserved in the offshore. The problem is that the shoreline has already rolled over those and reworked those. And so what remains isn't sort of just a drowned version of its previous self, but it's actually been modified. So much more difficult to do that. And that's why most of our records only go back 1,000 or 2,000 years at this stage.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jeff Donnelly of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about his work reconstructing records of past storm activity. Jeff, earlier this month, you and a number of colleagues published a study that was a 2,000-year record of hurricane activity as it impacted Salt Pond in Falmouth on Cape Cod. What was the particular motivation for that study and for that length of a record?
Well, we're always trying to get as long a record as we can. We were fortunate that Salt Pond actually provided a 2,000-year record because of that sea level rise issue I was just talking about.
So we do have a sense that Salt Pond has been there as a coastal pond over that length of time.
Exactly right. Right. About 2,000 years ago is when it became connected to the ocean and became a salt pond. Prior to that, it was a freshwater pond going back to several thousand years ago, maybe 10,000, 11,000 years ago. But those earlier times, it wasn't close to the ocean, so it wasn't recording these sorts of events. It wasn't until the ocean sort of intercepted it about 2,000 years ago that it became, recording these sorts of flooding events. The motivation, we've been doing this work all over the world, really, in the Pacific and in the Caribbean, Bahamas, places like that. But obviously, there was a real interest to do it close to home as well. We're clearly vulnerable to hurricanes. We saw Irene and Sandy a few years ago. People remember Hurricane Bob in 1991. Some old timers probably remember the 1938 hurricane,
right,
which was one of the more devastating ones that hit Long Island and central New England. So we wanted to get a better understanding of the long-term variability in storminess, and try to put the modern in context. And try to see if there were patterns that we might be able to discern what's the climate drivers of changes in climate and changes in hurricane climate might be. And there's a lot of debate in the scientific community right now about how the current warming that we're experiencing might impact tropical cyclone activity. But we're really handicapped by this very short instrumental record that, we only have 150 or 160 years worth of record, and there's only a handful of storms, for example, that have been really intense that have hit New England in that time. And the statistics aren't very good to try to understand what the drivers of that variability might be. Whereas this perspective takes us back 2,000 years, and we can start asking some pretty interesting questions about how hurricanes varied in climates that are potentially very different than what we've experienced today.
So give us the short version. What was the major takeaway from 2,000 years worth of storm activity in this one spot in Falmouth?
Well, one of the things that jumped out at us was that the earlier part of the record was much more active than the most recent part of the record, and that the first millennium AD in particular was quite active with lots of very big layers. And there was this other interval between about 1400 and 1675 AD that was also very active. And then the last few hundred years was very inactive, relatively. And first, you know, you're always cautious about, well, is this just a site-specific sort of pattern? You know, is this something that we're only recording here because there was a change in the barrier or there was change, some local change? But as we sort of compiled the other records that we had been generating from around the Atlantic, we noticed that there were some really coherent patterns. And for example, this most recent active interval between about 1400 and 1675 AD is one in which the activity all along the East Coast is quite active, in the sense that sites in North Carolina, for example, and the Bahamas are all very active at that interval, whereas other sites in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico are very quiet. There's very few event beds in those sites. And then this earlier interval is one in which everybody was active. You know, as you go into the first millennium in the Gulf of Mexico or in the Caribbean or in the Northeast or in the Carolinas, you see that there's many more event beds in that interval. And so there was this, you know, regionality to it that was sort of surprising, and that some places were active and other places were inactive. And then at other times, everybody was active.
When you say active,
right?
I mean, in the title of the paper that you published, you use the word unprecedented. Mm-hmm. In the press release that Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution put out, they talk about monster storms. These are some pretty strong words coming from scientists who are pretty usually conservative and pretty, you know, you're going to use the technical term for it. So what are we talking about in terms of activity to be calling these unprecedented monster storms?
So in the sense of the salt pond record, there were only three events that were recorded in the historic interval. Hurricane Bob, which was the smallest event bed of the entire historic record, which is a Category 2 storm. Most people probably remember it. Not, you know, one of the more classic, you know, more memorable catastrophic storms in New England history, but, you know, a solid Category 2 storm. The only other two that were recorded in Salt Pond were in the 17th century, and one of which is the 1635 Great Colonial Hurricane, which is probably the most intense hurricane to strike Cape Cod in the historic interval. We only know as much as we do about it because it happened to pass between the only two places that there were Europeans on the landscape writing things down at the time. And so the eye of the storm actually passed right between Plymouth and Boston. But that was probably a very strong Category 3 storm, probably very similar to the 1938 hurricane, but it made landfall much further to the east. As we go back further in time, though, the event beds get much larger, or many of the event beds get much larger. So these earlier storms, or at least many of them, were able to transport even more sediment than what is the most intense storm probably of the historic record, the 1635 event. On top of that, we know that sea level has been rising, and so this barrier has been transgressing landward, so moving landward through time as sea level has risen. And so the sediment, not only are these sediment beds larger, in the first millennium, for example, but the sediment had to be transported even further than it is today. Today, you have to transport these sands about 400 or so meters to this hole in Salt Pond where the sediment cores are taken. In the past, it might have had 500 or 600 meters. So you're transporting more sediment a greater distance. And so that suggests that these were more powerful storms. Now, we don't exactly know how much more powerful. You know, it could have been that it was like a 1635 that made a more direct landfall, that sort of thing. I don't think we're talking about Category 5 hurricanes or something like that up in the Northeast. We're probably talking about strong Category 3 and perhaps even Category 4 storms. But that's enough. I mean, we don't need to...
That's quite enough.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, as New Englanders, we're used to nor'easters, we're used to a good tropical storm and a good blow here and there. But a Category 4 storm in New England, to me, almost sounds like, you know, that it just seems like it wouldn't even be possible. How warm would the water have to be to sustain that? What would be necessary to even make it physically possible to have a Category 4 storm on Cape Cod?
The trouble is that it's we do have the Gulf Stream that comes up and provides this pulse of warm water that's there for the hurricanes to feed off of. But right off of Cape Cod, it's much cooler sea surface temperatures typically. And if a storm is moving slowly, it's going to interact with those cooler sea surface temperatures and lose intensity. The problem is that most of these storms, as they're moving up the eastern seaboard, tend to accelerate. And for example, the 1938 hurricane was moving at about 60 miles an hour. And so what we have is a Category 4 or 5 hurricane that's parked off of North Carolina, accelerates up the eastern seaboard, and doesn't have enough time to interact with those cooler sea surface temperatures and lose intensity. And the other thing that's going on is that even as it does lose some of its intensity, because it's accelerating, you're actually adding that acceleration to the right side of the storm. The winds you actually feel on the ground are accentuated because the storm's moving forward faster. And so even though the rotary winds might be only Category 3, if it's moving forward fast enough, you might actually be feeling Category 4 winds on the ground.
How surprised were you and your colleagues when you saw these results? I mean, you've been, as you've alluded to, putting together storm records around the Northeast and around the Atlantic, maybe had a sense of what was going on in the past. I mean, did you look at that and go, yeah, that's kind of what we had a sense was going on and it confirmed our hunch? Or was this a real surprise?
The earlier part, the first millennium record, that's something that we'd seen just about everywhere we had gone. So it wasn't particularly surprising that that was quite active at Salt Pond. What was surprising is this interval between about 1400 and 1675. That's not an interval that we had some clues about. You know, we had found some event beds at some other sites in New England that dated to about that interval. We didn't have the really detailed record that we have from Salt Pond. So it was really a surprise to see just how active that particular interval was.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Jeff Donnelly. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with marine geologist Dr. Jeff Donnelly of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about his work reconstructing records of past storm activity and what the past can tell us about the risks we face from climate change. We invite you to join our conversation as well. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Jeff, before the break, you were talking about these two different periods mm-hmm. of intense storm activity. The first millennium AD, where you're seeing from records all around the Atlantic, in the tropics, the Bahamas, up the East Coast, that it was very active everywhere. And then this period a few hundred years later, where we're seeing a lot of what looks like hurricane activity kind of along the East Coast and into the Northeast, but not so much in the tropics. Do we have a sense of what the different conditions are? What might explain those differences in activity?
Yeah, we do. We've got some proxy data for what sea surface temperatures have been doing in particular in the North Atlantic over that time period. The first millennium interval is one in which the deep tropics tends to be much warmer than the average.
And deep tropics, we're talking about latitude here, not depth in the ocean.
Right, right. So we're talking about, you know, between down in the Caribbean and further out into the tropical North Atlantic, sea surface temperatures were warmer in that particular interval. And so what we think was going on was that was fueling more hurricane activity across the entire basin. You were, you know, more classical hurricane development in the deep tropics, and those are spraying all along the western margin of the Atlantic. Including the Northeast, the Gulf, and the Caribbean. This later interval is very different in that the Caribbean is inactive, the Gulf is inactive at that interval, and it's only along the eastern seaboard from the Bahamas to the Carolinas to New England that sees activity. And this is right at the transition from what we call the medieval warm period to the Little Ice Age. And so in general, temperatures are getting cooler across the northern hemisphere at this interval. And so it struck us as very odd that this would be an interval that you'd get increased hurricane activity. But it turns out what's going on is that while the deep tropics are getting cooler at this transition to the Little Ice Age, there's actually a warm sea surface temperature anomaly that occurs along the eastern United States. And so, you know, basically from the Caribbean up along into even the Gulf of Maine records this. So you've got this transition to generally cooler conditions across the North Atlantic, except for this area along the western margin of the basin. And that seems to be contributing to this active interval. And one of the things that happens during this sort of interval is that the hurricanes that only impact the eastern seaboard are not storms that form in the deep tropics. There's storms like Bob that actually form off the southeastern coast of the U.S. near the Bahamas. One of the things that happens with these storms is that they're not forming from these tropical waves that are coming off of Africa and coming up over the tropical Atlantic. They're actually forming from prior extratropical disturbances that form off the southeastern coast of the U.S. And so there's a bit different genesis of them, and those are forming, and there's warmer sea surface temperatures, and then these storms are then just impacting along the eastern seaboard of the U.S.
The picture that you're putting together there, it strikes me that, you know, you've got your sediment core that we talked about mm-hmm. with the different layers of sand, and you can tell when a storm hit.
Right.
But then what you're talking about is pulling a huge amount of other data together about how warm sea surface temperature was at different places and what was going on in a much larger climate context, not to mention all of these different storm records. And then one of the things I found reading your study really interesting is that even just to put together that sediment core and figure out when those storms happened.
Right.
I mean, this is an intense amount of work. So give us a sense of some of the different types of data and how you actually put together this bigger picture besides just saying, oh, there were, 10 hurricanes that hit this pond in this sediment core.
Right, right. I mean, one of the biggest challenges is trying to date the core itself. So we have to figure out when these storms occurred. And we can use radiocarbon, for example, which will tell us how long it's been since a plant fragment that might be preserved in the core has been around, or how long it's been since it was accumulating its carbon from the atmosphere. But then there's also other stratigraphic tools that we can use to data. It turns out the humans actually create some big environmental changes that are preserved in the core that we know the age of, for example.
Like what?
Well, for example, the Europeans show up and the first thing they did was cut down all the trees. And so if you look at the pollen that's preserved in the core, there's all this open or forest pollen. And then all of a sudden, about 1670 or so in this region, much of the tree pollen goes away and you get a lot of pollen like ragweed and sorrel and all these sort of invasive weeds and things that come in. Hmm. And so you can see very distinctly in the pollen record when Europeans showed up and started modifying the landscape. And actually, one of the reasons we have that 1675 hurricane bed so well dated is that the sample below it is the first sample that actually had rye pollen in it. And so it's right after Europeans settle in Falmouth, clear the landscape, and start planting winter rye. Some of that rye pollen actually ends up in Salt Pond, and we can find it in the core. And so we can really precisely date that storm to right after Europeans settled the area.
That's a fascinating bit of sleuthing to put that all together.
Right.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with marine geologist Dr. Jeff Donnelly. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Joel, what's on your mind?
Well, I think you just answered my question. I could not figure out how one would detect a baseline and of what kind of data that would unite these far-flung areas of investigation, and whether you just related it all to today's time, and maybe you use a lot of just geological information on evidence of shifting shorelines and things having little to do with actual deposited sediment and water and stuff like that.
So, Joel, I think what you're getting at there is kind of what we were just talking about, this how do you take a tube of mud and really make sense of it and put dates on it? And you were talking about the pollen. Are there other...
Right.
I mean, when you're talking about 100, 200 years ago, you said you can also use radiocarbon. Are there other tools for trying to match up? I mean, obviously, you're not going to see rye pollen showing up in a record in the Bahamas. And so you've got to do this differently in every place where you look at a record, right?
Right. Other things are global disturbances that we see. Another example is that in the early 1950s, we started exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. Hmm. That actually rained out a non-naturally occurring radioisotope called cesium-137 all over the planet, and we actually find that in the core. So you can look in the core and basically think, okay, there's no cesium-137 here, there's no 137 here, then bam, you start seeing it. Okay, now we know we're in the early 1950s. And there's actually a peak of it just prior to the nuclear test weapons ban in 1963. And so we can actually say, okay, well, here we are. We're in 1963. Here's the peak in cesium-137. So there's an example of a global signal. And then there's other signals that are sort of more regional in scale. One's the sort of lead pollution, for example. Lots of lead got put into the atmosphere during the Industrial Revolution, and we see that all over the Northeast. Every pond or marsh that we go to, we can look at the lead concentrations and pretty much see exactly when the Industrial Revolution cranks up. So we sort of throw all these different tools at it, including radiocarbon, and we could put together a pretty detailed chronology of the events going back, you know, 2 millennia.
What kind of team do you have to put together? Is, you know, you're talking about lead and radionuclides and rye pollen, and this is a lot of history and environmental history. Is this something where you can kind of go to some reference that you have in your office and say, oh, here are different things that we might be able to look for in our core? Or do you have to be working with a whole team of historians and anthropologists and experts in a lot of different fields to put this all together?
Well, most of this has been all pretty well worked out at this stage. So we know the sorts of things that we're looking for, what provides really good dated stratigraphic markers, for example. Some analyses are much easier to do than others. Things like lead pollution we can do, you know, analytically in a few hours with a core scanner. The pollen bit is a much more labor-intensive, where I actually have to hire someone who knows the different pollen taxa and sits in front of a microscope and counts them grain by grain, right? So it's sort of an old-school technique that involves lots of labor hours. So
that would definitely take dedication.
Yeah.
I want to shift gears here a little bit. To me, as surprising as the really active past is this idea that the past few hundred years, what for all of us we define as normal,
right,
actually seems to be perhaps the anomaly, the quiet period in the past 2,000 years. Has it really been that quiet? Is that perhaps an artifact of something changing that we're just not picking up the storms? Or have things really been quieter for the past 300 or so years? And do we know why?
Right. Well, in almost every site we've looked at, there's only one or two exceptions. The last few hundred years are the most quiet. This is from the Gulf of Mexico, the Caribbean, and in the Northeast. That's not to say we haven't had any hurricane strikes, and actually the middle part of the 20th century was quite active, and New England saw its fair share. The Cape was pretty lucky. There was a whole series of events in the mid-20th century, starting with that 1938 hurricane. There was another hurricane in 1944, two storms in 1954, and then Hurricane Donna in 1960. Most of those storms made landfall in Long Island and had an impact in southeastern New England, but we were sort of spared the brunt of it. So in that sense, we've sort of seen sort of a fair amount of activity. But when you start looking at these longer timescales, these earlier intervals were much more active than even that. And in terms of cause, I think one of the things that's been going on is that for much of that historic interval since Europeans settled the landscape has been one in which we've been in the Little Ice Age. We've only been out of the Little Ice Age for 100 years or so. And so for much of that interval, post this warm sea surface temperature anomaly that I was talking about that ended, you know, roughly the late 17th century, conditions were pretty cold in terms of the sea surface temperatures. And it would probably limited the number of really intense hurricane strikes that we got. We certainly got some hurricanes, but they weren't the sort of the scale of the 1938 hurricane.
This study has largely, by yourself and by the media, been interpreted as saying, you know, during these periods of warmer sea surface temperatures, we saw much more intense hurricane activity, even than perhaps we had expected to see. We are currently warming sea surface temperatures again, so maybe this is an indicator of what we could see in the future.
Right.
There's kind of an alternative possible interpretation of this, which is that over the past 2,000 years, without the influence of humans, we've seen much more activity than we're currently seeing. Maybe this whole climate change thing isn't such a big deal. So kind of weigh those two interpretations for me. How do we take what you're seeing in the past record and incorporate that into our thoughts about the future?
So, I mean, this is one of the real values, I think, of this study is that it gives us this much longer timescale perspective. And when you just ask that simple question, you know, how has hurricane activity varied over the last 2 millennia? You see that there's significant variability and there's these intervals that were much more active than what we've experienced historically. The issue of climate change and the human-induced climate change is that we know from our observations over the last century that sea surface temperatures are warming. We have a really good sense that we're contributing to much of that with our greenhouse gas emissions. And so the theoretical side of the science, people that are sort of looking at the dynamics of hurricanes and how they form and how intense they get, all point to more intense hurricanes as you warm the sea surface temperatures. But we don't have a very good historical record to examine that. So what this provides us is a way to look at other climates in the recent past that may provide some analogs for the future. When we do that, it turns out that the two intervals that I've been talking about that are more active than what we've experienced are ones in which there are elevated sea surface temperatures. And so in that sense, it's providing support for these theoretical studies that suggest that we should get more intense hurricanes with warmer sea surface temperatures. Now, the reason we may not have seen the upswing in hurricane activity, particularly here, I mean, I think if you look at the last couple of decades, it's been quite active across the Atlantic Basin. We've been pretty lucky here in the Northeast. Most of the activity has been down south in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico. It's only been a couple of decades, actually, since the sea surface temperatures have sort of exceeded these earlier warm intervals that I was talking about.
So we're now warmer than we were, say, in that first millennium when,
that's right,
when things were very
right.
active.
But we've only been warmer for a few decades. And so that's not a lot of time. Even in the peak of this active interval between 1400 and 1675, we were seeing these big hurricanes about once every 20 years or so. So even then, the frequency, it's not like we're getting one every year.
Right.
It's every 20 years. And we've only experienced this warm climate of the global warming era for a few decades, or at least that has exceeded these earlier intervals of sea surface temperatures. So one of the things that may be gone is we just haven't had enough time in this warm interval to sort of fully see the active interval. Now, we might be, if you lived in the panhandle of Florida, for example, you might have a very different perspective because they've been getting hit quite often down there, particularly in the middle part of the 2000s. And so there's this regionality to it. There's still this, sort of randomness about who gets hit and when, and there's steering currents that are driving the tracks this way or that way on these sort of interdecadal timescales. And so it's possible that we just haven't quite seen, enough time in this warmer climate to sort of fully see what we might expect. That being said, we have just in the last couple of years seen Irene and we've seen Sandy, and we had a scare in 2010 with Earl, which was a Category 4 storm off of the North Carolina that fortunately went out to sea. So it's not as though it's been completely quiet here.
Yeah, I mean, we had 3 years in a row, Earl being, I think, the first of them. And I remember last year on Labor Day weekend going, oh, no Labor Day storm, because we'd had 3 years in a row of a near hurricane, tropical storm, strong storm right around Labor Day.
Right.
And had kind of almost gotten used to that. And then we had this quiet year last year that was almost felt odd after that. Those three years of stronger storms.
And I think those storms, Irene and Sandy, caused a fair amount of damage, but they're, very weak compared to the storms that we're talking about. They're, in the case of Irene, it was a tropical storm when it made landfall. In the case of Sandy, it was a minimal Category 1 intensity when it made landfall. So, these are much less intense than the storms that we're talking about, and they still caused an immense amount of damage. Mostly because sea level's been rising and we've built this fixed infrastructure at the coastline that's just getting more and more vulnerable as time goes on. And so the real fear is that, we've got this fixed infrastructure that's getting more and more vulnerable all the time. And even without climate change giving us more intense hurricanes, potentially, we're going to get hit. It's just a matter of time before the big one comes back and we get another intense hurricane strike, regardless of climate change. And we've got this fixed infrastructure that's getting more and more vulnerable. So we need to do something about that.
So in some ways, even if we took climate change out of the picture, we've built what we think of as America. We've built America during a period of pretty low hurricane activity, at least for the Northeast. This more quiet 300 years. And so even without that, you're kind of saying we're really vulnerable. We're sitting here not
That's
really
right.
aware of what our
That's
true
right.
vulnerability is.
And I think one of the things that was really a wake-up call for us looking at our results from the Northeast is that then we take this longer timescale and go back 2,000 years without, as you were saying earlier, without our intervention in the climate itself was able to come together and generate intervals of hurricane activity like we hadn't seen before. So that's not very reassuring, in the sense that, you know, regardless of our interference with the climate, the climate system can generate conditions that give us, an intense hurricane strike every 20 years. You know, we could easily return to that without sort of worrying about global warming and human-induced climate change. And that's a bigger issue, I think, in terms of how we deal with, most of the coastal infrastructure that we built is only in the last 100 years. If you go back to historic maps and things like that, the only thing we had built on the coast during some of these earlier hurricane strikes were some salt works and fishing shacks and those sorts of things. But in the last 100 years or so, mostly post-World War II, we've developed entire communities on vulnerable landscapes. Looking at places like Atlantic City, we've built entire cities on barrier islands, for example. So we've made ourselves much more vulnerable. And all of this was done without really understanding the context that sea level was rising, was likely to rise even faster. And now there's this specter that the storminess may actually increase as well.
Talking about the infrastructure that's been built, I mean, Salt Pond in Falmouth, you were talking about, the dunes move. Well, we've built a road there. There's no longer really a dune there. There's just a road. Do you see that show up in the record in any way? Does that affect perhaps what the record of the past few decades looks like?
It doesn't appear so, though we haven't really given it a good test with any good hurricanes. Bob was the only one that's really made landfall and was recorded in the last 100 years there. These other hurricanes I was talking about in the middle part of the 20th century certainly impacted Cape Cod, but not as severely as closer to their landfall on Long Island. And those storms don't appear to be recorded at Salt Pond. It's only the ones that make a fairly close landfall that appear to be recorded. So we don't really have a good sense for how much we've impacted our sensitivity to the actual landfalls. That being said, we should be getting more sensitive because we've basically flattened the dune. It should be easier to overtop it and transport sediment to where we're collecting the cores from. So
that's marine geologist Dr. Jeff Donnelly of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is marine geologist Dr. Jeff Donnelly. He's the lead author on a new study showing that over the past 2,000 years, the Northeast has seen periods of intense hurricane activity when sea surface temperatures were warmer. Our toll-free phone number here at Living Lab is 866-999-4626. Fritz is on the line from Kitituat. Good morning, Fritz.
Good morning.
What's your question for Dr. Donnelly?
Hi, I am curious about if there were major storms between 1675 and the hurricane of 38, which affected harbors along the south coast of Cape Cod, since there's Kitituat and Hyannis and all of the ponds around here.
There were a number of hurricanes in that interval that impacted the region. 1723, there's one 1727, 1760, let's see, 1815. Most of those storms, save 1815, were fairly weak. They were probably in the Category 1 or perhaps Category 2 status. The 1815 was very similar in intensity, we think, to the 1938 hurricane, and actually just made landfall a few kilometers away from where the 1938 made landfall on Long Island. And there was a lot of storm surge up into Buzzards Bay during that storm, just as there was in 1938. But again, it was sort of a far-field hurricane for us, and we sort of just got the sideswipe from it out here in the Cape.
All right, and also on the phone, Bill from Barnstable. Bill, what's on your mind?
I'd just like to comment. I work for the National Weather Service, and I think I really appreciate this long-term study that puts a bigger context on climate change. You know, this recent winter weather we've had, all the media wants to say this, the historic, and your guest point earlier, this is a really relatively short period of time as far as, looking at this. But so I appreciate the study, and I just want to comment on that.
Well, Fritz and Bill, thank you both for your phone calls. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Jeff, you're over here nodding along as he's saying, this is a relatively short time period. Our whole sense of what is historic is perhaps skewed just by the fact that, we only know what we've experienced, really.
Right, right. And even that instrumental record that I was describing earlier that goes back 160 years is not of even quality in the sense that we've really only monitored every hurricane that's occurred since the satellite era, when we could actually put a satellite up and take pictures of every single hurricane that's occurred. In the earlier part of that record, we were only recording hurricanes that actually made landfall somewhere or encountered a ship at sea, and the ship survived and happened to make a note of it. And so even the quality of the record that we have isn't very good going back 160 years.
Now, Jeff, you are one of four scientists at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution who recently collectively received a $1 million grant from the MacArthur Foundation to not only conduct your research on past storminess and sea level rise, ocean acidification, a whole range of climate change impacts on the ocean, but then translate that to information that the public, communities, homeowners, politicians can use to make decisions about how to address this vulnerability that we were talking about along our coastlines. How do you see that playing out? What kinds of information are you trying to get to the public and to decision makers, and what kinds of decisions might you want to influence?
Well, it's a real challenge. We unless I get the opportunity to speak on a show like this, or get some sort of media coverage of our work, people aren't going to go and dig and find my papers and read them and try to figure out where they should buy a house or where they shouldn't buy a house. And so there's a real challenge for us scientists to try to translate our data into products that might actually be useful to people.
Do you think you have information that could help people decide where to buy or build a house?
Oh, certainly. I use that information when I bought my house, for example.
Bought inland?
Yes, I'm at about 40 feet. So even with projected sea level rise, I should be in pretty good shape. And everybody should have the information that I have. We know sea level is rising. We know ballpark that it's probably going to rise another 3 or 4 feet in the next century. We know that storminess has changed considerably over the last 2 millennia. Now we know that. But even without that, we know that these storms occur occasionally and that we need to be prepared for them. So the challenge is sort of how to take our long-term records and make them into something that might be useful to people. And because, obviously, sea level has been rising since the 1938 hurricane, so the risk isn't static. It's not as though when you bought your house in 1940 that the risk is the same today as it was then. We know sea level has risen already a foot since then, and it's forecast to rise another couple of feet in the next century. So, making tools for people to be able to look and say, okay, well, where is sea level today relative to my house? How vulnerable am I today? How vulnerable might I be in 50 years? Sort of thing, I think would be something that people would find useful.
I mean, what kind of tools are we talking about? We've got, obviously, FEMA puts out the flood maps,
right,
which is one thing that a lot of homeowners on the Cape and Islands are now very familiar with, and they're pretty controversial. So how do you get that information out there in a way that people can understand and really, wrap their heads around and use?
Right, right. Well, one of the lessons that I've learned in trying to deal with decision makers and the general public on this is that they relate much better to an actual event rather than some statistical assessment of their risk or some hypothetical, or what they perceive as sort of a hypothetical result out of a climate model. They really relate to an event that you can actually describe to them that really occurred and what that might mean if it came back today. And so one of the things that we're doing is we've hindcast many of the storm surges from some of these historic events, and we can actually superimpose them on the sea level rise that's already occurred since those events happened. So, for example, we could say, what would happen if the 1938 hurricane came back and hit today in the same exact conditions, except that sea level is a foot higher? Who would be at risk? Who would get flooded? How fast would they get flooded? Where are the roads that are going to be cut off because of the storm tide, those sorts of things? That's a little more hands-on data that people can take and say, have some appreciation for what they might expect during one of these events, rather than sort of just a line drawn on a map by a federal agency.
Now, how do you envision that playing out, though? I mean, we've already got homes. This isn't about, should I build a home on the coast or should we build a road there? We've already got coastal development throughout the Northeast.
Right.
So how do you see this playing out in the next few decades? Are we looking at having to retreat significantly somehow?
Well, I think there's a variety of things we can do. One, retreat is one of those. I mean, I think if we're in a really vulnerable stretch of coastline that clearly isn't sustainable, retreat might be the only option. Another situation might be where we have a really expensive piece of coastal infrastructure that we're committed to keeping, and we invest a lot in armoring it to keep it where it is. I think, you know, there's a real challenge in sort of how we deal with the federal flood insurance program, which is effectively subsidizing the insurance for people at the coastline. It came about because the private insurers basically pulled out of the market in the 60s. They realized that they couldn't charge the rates that they needed to actually make it profitable. So the federal government effectively took over that risk, which means all the taxpayers are basically contributing to sort of subsidize this insurance policy. It's been underwater for decades. It hasn't been, you know, literally underwater, but it's been losing money consistently. And so there's a real challenge with sort of how we deal with that. And some of the critics of that program, you know, are complain that it's actually subsidizing us to build and develop in areas that are too risky. So I think we need to rethink how we're sort of dealing with that disaster response. And how we, you know, if a community gets destroyed during a hurricane or at least damaged, you know, how do we rebuild? We have to rebuild in smart ways. And if it's a, you know, really vulnerable area, we probably need to subsidize people not to rebuild in that area, but to move them to other areas.
Have you tried taking this message directly to homeowners who are at significant risk? I mean, this is a really tough message to take, even if, you know, the town doesn't consider your home critical infrastructure. That's your home and your investment.
Mm-hmm.
And something very sentimental as well as economic. How do you convince people that perhaps it's time to go?
I'm not advocating that we sort of move people out of their homes ahead of the storm. I think, you know, a storm's going to come, it's going to damage a community, then we're going to have to make some tough decisions about whether we rebuild in that particular community. I think the most important thing that we need to get out, though, is that there's a need to sort of improve our infrastructure in such a way to enable us to get people out of harm's way from these storms. And we can always rebuild a house. We can, you know, figure out ways to sort of deal with the economic fallout of these events. But sort of saving lives should be the number one priority. And I think that's a real concern because, as I mentioned earlier, these storms are moving very rapidly as they come up the eastern seaboard. So, you know, if they're moving at 50 or 60 miles an hour, like the 1938 hurricane, they're covering the distance between North Carolina and New England in about 8 hours. So we don't have a lot of time to get an enormous population out of harm's way. And, you know, we don't have very good, haven't had very much practice at it either. You know, we've been relatively fortunate over the last few decades. And even Sandy, while, you know, posing some challenges, was moving so slowly. It was really moving anomalously slowly for a storm at this latitude. We had days of advance warning in terms of trying to get people out of harm's way for that. We won't usually have that. We're only going to have 8 or 10 hours to sort of get people out of harm's way. And I think that's a more critical point. And then, you know, there's obviously these financial challenges post-event that we'll have to wrestle with as well.
I think there's a real hunger for this kind of information among the public. Do you find that with politicians as well? Do you have, lawmakers or decision makers kind of coming to you and saying, can you help us? Do you have information that we can use to shape policies for the future?
I think so. They do. It's sort of tough just to talk the same language sometimes, you know. This is new for me, too. I'm trained as a scientist. I'm not trained to sort of communicate with decision makers and that sort of thing. And so there's this language thing. It takes us an hour or two just to try to start speaking the same language. But and that's one of the nice things about this MacArthur Award, that it's actually giving scientists support to actually think about this and start thinking about how they might translate their results to the public and make meaningful contributions to the public discourse about these problems, and not just be publishing in these scientific journals that, you know, perhaps none of these decision makers would ever read.
That's marine geologist Jeff Donnelly of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Jeff, thank you, and best of luck with those efforts.
Great, thanks.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You, of course, can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.